We're going to call the Senate Interim Committee on Education to order. We have a number of informational meetings for today, and I appreciate all the people who've taken time out of their day to be here. So to begin with, we'll open an informational hearing on seismic retrofitting, and we'll have our two members that we are happy to have here today, because we may not be able to have them here in a couple of days. So with that, we'll have Senator Devlin and Senator Farioli come on up. Did I open it? Yeah. I think I opened it. So we'll make sure we open the information. Yes.
Do you want me?
And thanks.
I do.
Okay. There are a lot of stuff has happened, and you have a lot to do with all of that happening. So we'd love to hear from you. And if you need to talk about other things, you know, just go forth with whatever you need to expound on.
So you want to get something off
your chest. So I don't make this mistake that I made yesterday. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. And I'm here today to shake things up.
Okay.
thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I was asked here to talk about seismic bonds, obviously in this particular case what we call M bonds, but I would like to talk a little bit before that about some background. If you were to talk about this issue in general and talk about the needs of public schools in terms of capital, I would be the first in line to say that this is a local responsibility that's defined in state statute, it's defined in the Constitution as a local responsibility. But the underlying reality is that any time a child is at risk in this state, any time that a child's health is actually threatened, we could say it's a local responsibility, but in the end, the responsibility rests with us. And I think in the case of the M bonds, and I'm going to talk just briefly, since you'll give me the discretion, a little bit about P bonds, I think the state has taken on some responsibilities here that are very important. Now, I want to be very careful here, and Senator Farioli will probably be careful too, because you cannot mention seismic in this building without mentioning the Senate President, because the Senate President is literally everything seismic. He's looking. But
he's
of course,
watching.
In that particular case, he has a long history in that area and has done a lot of work. But I think it's important to remember that after he did all of that work, and other people in this building did the work also, and that's always the case in this building. Originally, our appropriations to the program were quite meager. In fact, between, I believe, 09 and 14, over several bienniums, our total expenditures on the seismic portion for schools was about $34 million. Now, I'm not going to say $34 million is meager in the sense that that's a meager amount of dollars, but in terms of the need, it was very meager. Then in the 15-17 biennium, we appropriated $175 million. And we actually also started under the P bonds, which are for public schools. And P bonds are largely created to try to assist school districts that are having difficulty passing bond measures. And while I may reside in a school district where there are very high assessed values and bonds are in a good economy and it's possible to pass bonds for school districts, many school districts in this state have both economic conditions and they have limited assessed value. So a relatively small bond in a school district with a very limited assessed value can equal out to a much higher rate for the individuals within that school district. And both of these have been very successful, both the M bonds and the P bonds have been very successful in addressing some of the needs in these school districts. The P bonds in particular have been successful in leveraging additional dollars in school districts, because many school districts have been able to pass bond measures that hadn't been able to pass bond measures in decades. And like I've said before, if a school is in such a condition that you know, children's health or safety are being threatened, ultimately that's our responsibility. I'm not saying that we should take over that responsibility, but we do have a responsibility to assist. This last biennium, we cut down that expenditure level to $100 million in the M bonds and $100 million in the P bonds. Now, That seems like a reduction, and it is a reduction. But I'm less concerned about that reduction than I am about the future of these measures, because I actually believe that if we planned well, we could continue at the level we are now of 17-19 for probably the next decade. But one of our underlying difficulties in this building with capital expenditures is we don't do the type of long-term planning that I had hoped that we would. I have spent the best part of over a decade trying to get the capital process more public. I've been successful in that effort because I can remember when I first came here, and Senator Farioli came here at the same time and in the other chamber, capital projects largely were decided in a back room between the presiding officers and occasionally the governor. It's a much more public process now, but we really do not have the type of long-range planning we should have so that when we undertake issues like this that need a long-term commitment, that we can say that we are making a long-term commitment. I hope that my colleagues that are remaining here and the future members of the legislature understand the importance of this commitment, even if it's $200 million a biennium, which is significant because our GO bond authority is a little bit over $1 billion a biennium and will only grow modestly over the foreseeable future. And so it's a significant portion of that, but it's a very important area to be expending dollars in. But it's going to take some long-term planning and commitment to do this, and I'm just hoping that the people that are here continue that commitment. I know that I will not be here that long, and I believe my colleague to my left will not be here that long. Senator Courtney might here be longer than I'm here on the earth. But with that, I'd like to close, and with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, since I'm not invited to testify on those, you've got a lot of good items on the agenda. I did want to put in a good word for the College Possible, and I did want to put in a quick word. I know it's off the record. It's not on the appropriate item. We struggled with the Cascades campus during this particular session, and I think you can either fund the proposal that's going to come to you in 18, or you'll end up funding it in 19. It would be much better if you funded it in 18. I did have a little bit of issue in the House because people were asking me the question, well, do we really want a four-year university in Bend? And I said, that was a decision that was made a long time ago. And so you're gonna get a full presentation from the people here today. I'm just hoping that the legislature keeps that commitment. And I'll be glad to answer any of my questions, and I look forward. We're going to be testifying a lot together. Maybe not here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ted Farioli, District 30. I can't really add much to the history of the issue, the way the funding rolled out, but there's an emotional content that I'd like to point out. That $34 million that was authorized, wasn't that also for public buildings, schools and public buildings?
There was a separate appropriation, but both of them are relatively small.
Right.
So I think it was schools and universities.
Well, please keep in mind, and all of you know this, the M and N doesn't mean anything. All it is when the bond, when the authority was given to us in the Constitution, but M bonds are for schools, N bonds are for emergency facilities.
Right.
And we started issuing them both at the same time. Our expenditures in both were meager. They still are in
right.
the case of emergency
yeah.
facilities.
So, colleagues, Mr. Chair, we spent an inordinate amount of time trying to educate Oregonians about the big one. And it isn't, you know, I hate to be cliche about this, it's not if, it's just when. And the problem that we have is making that eventuality real enough for people to do things, get a bug out bag, get a plan.
Sure.
You know, they've come to rely on their local school district as the place that they'll rendezvous. We're educating our kids to go there. And, you know, if they're separated or if there's a need for relocation or a need for emergency services. But what about those schools? When we started to look at the schools that had done their own retrofitting with bonding, we found that there was a robust effort to do those things in the communities. But a lot of that work hadn't been done. And it was simply beyond the capacity of some communities to get a bond passed. When you have engineers and public service and public safety folks talk to you about this issue, and they give you the numbers of schools statewide that are not retrofitted seismically, and they use the term pancake in describing what would happen to some of those schools in a serious seismic event, and they also describe that the prospects of survival in those buildings is virtually nil, then you start to realize, you know, if the local community can't do this work, and we don't do this work, there will come a time when we will have to stand in front of this building and face community members and parents whose children died because of our inaction. And that was such a spur to activity. We really might be guilty of almost theatrical hysterionics in pursuing the idea that it was our obligation to make sure that some funds were available for communities who were ready, willing, and able to take on the obligation of seismic retrofitting. So we put out $175 million, knowing that it probably was not sufficient, but the surprising part was that those allocations were oversubscribed almost immediately. So it was very clear that this was going to have to be an ongoing program of education and outreach, a longer-term commitment by the legislature to make resources available, so that if there is a community who, by its own lights, made the decision not to retrofit, it wouldn't be because we didn't make the resources available. Now that brings us to a different issue. It's related. It's not the issue in front of you. We have not done the things that we need to do for seismic retrofit of public safety buildings, places where first responders, fire crews, EMTs, healthcare professionals are going to be located in these emergencies. At some point in time, we have to address that issue as well. But if you were to set priorities, I would think that making sure the schools are available to function as community resources in an emergency, that mitigates toward emphasis on retrofitting those schools. That's where we are today. And I'm grateful that legislators supported the effort. I hope they'll continue to support the effort. It will eventually make a difference. It'll save lives. You know, maybe that is a phrase that gets used too much, but I don't want to be the person explaining to people, well, we just didn't prioritize it highly enough. Senator Devlin will be happy to take any of your technical questions.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? No questions.
Thank you, Mr.
Well, thank you very much.
Members of the committee, it's been an honor to testify.
We have three other individuals who I'd like to come forward: Morgan Allen, Michael Elliott, and Gloria Zacharias.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Very pleased to be here this afternoon to talk about, I think, one of the most important policy and funding initiatives the legislature has undertaken in the last couple of sessions, and that's the significant impacts in our school facilities and seismic upgrades for our school facilities. And as you heard earlier, historically in Oregon, the responsibility for construction of schools and capital construction in school districts has been primarily the responsibility of local communities and local taxpayers. And that's one of the things that Senator Devlin and Senator Farrelly didn't mention is what has resulted in that time is we have significant disparities when you travel around between school districts in Oregon. And it's not unusual in many of our school districts to see buildings 50, 75, or even 100 years old still in operation today, where grandparents went to the same schools as their grandchildren or great-grandchildren went to school. And really, up until 2015, Oregon was one of about a dozen states that, as the senators mentioned, provided a real minimal investment in school facilities. And that changed dramatically with the $175 million investment in the seismic program and the $125 million in the creation of the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program. And just to put on the record a couple things that have happened just from that investment the legislature made in the 2015-17 biennium, Oregon now has an Office of School Facilities at the Department of Education, and we have the beginnings of a school facilities database. Over 30 school districts, in fact, counting last week's election, now 36 school districts have passed bonds and received matching grants for the passage of those local bonds, including many districts that have not sought or passed bonds in decades. We've been able to fund so far, with the 2015 allocation, over 140 seismic safety improvement projects at schools or school buildings across the state. And 47 school districts have received technical assistance grants from the Department of Education to hire architects, engineers, or other specialists to come do assessments in preparation for going out for local bonds. So just to kind of give you a couple quick examples, in the first year of the capital matching program, we had 42 school districts go out for bonds, that was in 2016, and 23 of those 42 bonds passed. And you compare that to in the years 2013, 14, and 15 combined, we had 42 school districts go out and 22 of those bonds passed. So this program has already achieved its primary goal, which is to create incentives for local communities and local school districts to have conversations with their taxpayers about making investments in facilities. And then again, just last week, we had six school districts go out for bonds and pass and get matching programs. And we're in the beginning phases of the $100 million that Senator Devlin mentioned was allocated for seismic retrofits. That application process is open. So I think the message from the K-12 community and education folks is thank you. It's really created a great deal of excitement and enthusiasm and frankly hope and optimism in a lot of communities that have aging facilities and decaying infrastructure in their buildings across the districts. So, Senator Roblin, we're glad you're back because we were about ready to discuss the 28-vote landslide last week in the Coos Bay School District.
Yeah, exactly. It's pretty exciting. We're hoping it'll stay at least
that. Get a matching grant. But yes. I want to just turn it over. There's two people joining me today that will introduce themselves. Gloria Zacharias from Business Oregon, which is the state agency that runs the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, and Micah Elliott from the Department of Ed, who runs the Office of School Facilities and the Capital Matching Improvement Program. And I just want to say on behalf of all the K-12 folks that both of these people are exemplary public servants. The programs they run are gems, in my opinion, in state government. And our school district partners are very grateful. They've done an outstanding job. These are complicated programs to implement. They have complicated rules. We're talking about significant sums of money, $500 million over the last two bienniums. And we're very glad to have both of them at the helm of these programs. So I'll defer the rest of my time to them.
Thank you, Morgan. For the record, my name is Michael Elliott. I'm with the Office of School Facilities. I am the School Facilities Coordinator, and I want to talk briefly about AWSEM and TAP, or the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program. That's a lot to say, so we just call it the AWSEM program because it is, and the Technical Assistance Program and how they keep kids healthy, safe, and warm. As Morgan said, in 2015-17, we had 30 districts pass a local bond that receive a commitment from us. So $125 million in state money translated to $2.65 billion in local funds that were passed. So that's a total of about $2.7, $2.8 billion that are going to go to invest in local schools and local facilities across the state. Just point out that districts all over the state, it was not just the Big Five or the Big Ten or the Willamette Valley, but districts all over the state were successful in getting bonds. This does not reflect 2017, and otherwise we'd have Coos Bay on there because I'm being positive that 28 votes will hold. But, for example, we had small districts like Adrian School District pass a $950,000 bond. We matched them dollar for dollar. They built a new gym. Athena Weston passed a $4 million bond. They were able to buy buses and upgrade their school facilities, some long overdue needs in that district. Milton Freewater is a particular example. Not only did they get matching funds from us, they passed a bond, and they got some private funds to build a brand new middle school. Even bigger districts like Gresham Barlow, 30,000 votes were cast, and they won by about 1,000 votes, so a very slim margin. And the $8 million there, you know, that we were able to match them, we think helped push them over that edge and get more of their citizens say, yes, let's step up and invest in schools. So, again, very successful program. The types of projects that districts have been using this money for, some of it is seismic improvements. So the AWESOME program can go to any sort of capital expenditure. It's not limited to seismic, but definitely districts look at seismic investments as part of their work that they do with this program. They hope to use our funds to hopefully leverage more from Business Oregon. Building maintenance and expansion to address aging facilities is one of the biggest needs. For 2017-19, we already know which districts will be going for the first two elections. Obviously, the November 17 election has happened, and every district that applied received a commitment and passed. We had 100% passage rate of those that applied for the AWESOME program. And as you can see, we got a lot of districts from the southern, south, western part of the state, which we hadn't seen before. For the May 18 election, we're going to see another five districts have received a commitment, and we'll know in May whether they passed or not. But we're thinking it'll be good. The next program that I want to talk about is the Technical Assistance Program. And this is the program that is small grants designed to get districts to much larger sums of money. Right now, grants awarded in 2015-17, as Morgan said, went to three types of grants. One was a seismic assessment, a long-range facility plan, and facility assessment. Districts applied for facility assessments and long-range facility plans at a little greater rate than seismic assessments. But the goal of all of these is to get districts to have good information that they can then use to leverage larger sums of money. So the seismic assessment, if a district gets a seismic assessment grant and meets all of our standards, that application is qualified, can't say guaranteed, but qualified to meet to get to the seismic rehabilitation grant program. So not only we pay them to do the assessment by a qualified engineer, and then they turn around to use that assessment as the basis for their application of the seismic rehab grant program. And we have worked very closely with Business Oregon and Gloria to ensure that our standards meet their standards, and districts are, you know, we're being responsible with the public funds, and districts are getting value that they can use to leverage additional funds. The facilities assessments and long-range facility plans, those are now required to access the AWESOME program, those $4 to $8 million grants. And this helps districts be a little bit more thoughtful, a little bit more robust in their community conversations, and a little bit more forward-thinking about where they're going to be in 10 years so that they have a plan that they can work for and work towards when they go out to talk to their community about a bond. And that's so, again, they get money from that to access the larger sums of money later on. In 2017, I'm going to briefly talk about something not seismic related. The legislature passed Senate Bill 1062, which is the Healthy and Safe Schools Plan, and that created another assessment. So in the future, we'll have four types of assessments for the Technical Assistance Program. The goals are still the same, accessing larger money or fulfilling a larger responsibility. So facilities assessment, long-range facility plans, those will work directly hand-in-hand with the AWESOME program. Seismic assessments continue to work with the Seismic Rehabilitation Program. And then environmental assessments will help districts address their Healthy and Safe Schools Plan. These are more environmental hazards such as lead in the water, lead paint, radon, that sort of thing. It's not necessarily catastrophic or cataclysmic events. And now I'd like to turn over to Gloria, and I've just been really thrilled to work closely with her. We've aligned well. We've been able to just mesh, make sure that districts are getting the same answer across the state to ensure that we're maximizing the use of public funds to ensure that more students are kept healthy, safe, and warm.
Thank you. Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, my name is Gloria Zacharias, and I am with Business Oregon, and I am the coordinator of the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. And I would like to thank the Department of Education, and I would also like to thank you for thinking ahead and funding those assessment grants. They have been huge in the number of smaller districts, especially that have been able to access the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program, because those assessments are first. They're done first as part of the application process to apply for a grant to seismically rehab the buildings. So a lot of times those smaller districts just didn't have the funds to spare to do those assessments. And working with Michael and his group at the facilities office has been great. We've, like Michael said, we've aligned our programs so that the assessment that they pay for is qualifies people to apply for the seismic rehab grant. and that has worked beautifully. And I was telling Michael just today that I received another inquiry about where do we go for those technical assistance grants, and I was able to direct them to their website and to Michael's group, and that's worked very well. And I have heard many, many districts say that they would never have been able to apply for the seismic grant without those, so I'd like to thank you for that. The Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program came to Business Oregon in January of 2014, and the total amount of funding that has been awarded to date is $208,846,957 to school projects. That includes the a little over $18 million that it was awarded by OEM beginning in 2011. So that includes all of them. It's gone to 26 counties and 71 different school districts. That doesn't mean that there aren't some school districts that have received more than one, but there are 71 different school districts that have received a seismic rehabilitation grant. The rules were recently changed to increase the maximum grant amount from 1.5, which had been in effect since the beginning of the program, to now 2.5. And we also changed the rule to require the shelter projects, the gymnasiums, the cafeterias, the auditoriums, those buildings that are likely to be used as a shelter after an event, to be rehabilitated to the immediate occupancy standards. Classrooms, et cetera, are generally rehabbed to life safety standards, which means that anyone inside the building can get out safely, but the building may or may not be able to be used after an event. A lot of times it isn't that much more, and it's very cost effective to build it to immediate or to rehab it to immediate occupancy. So the committee, there's a 20-person advisory committee who makes these decisions. The committee recommended that we change our rules to require those shelter projects. I grew up in Joseph, and I happen to know that that high school is the biggest building, that gymnasium is the biggest building in town, and we used it for everything, as we did the cafeteria, auditorium. It was the same room. So those types of buildings, we believe, should be rehabbed to immediate occupancy. So starting with this round, which we have an open round of applications right now, it's open until January 31st, and we will be awarding the first $25 million. The bonds that were awarded to the program have been separated into two sales, one in 2018 and one in 2019. So the first $25 million is for schools for 2018, and that's what we're accepting applications for now through January 31st. I'm happy to give you any other information you'd like. So if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer those.
Any questions for these people? I just want to say thank you for managing this program well. I only hear good things from the districts that I've worked with. I'm sure that's in other places. And we have needed to do this. Without your help, it wouldn't have happened, because we've tried this in the past and people haven't applied because it was just, I think, too complex. And as you said, many of the small districts didn't have the capacity to get the work done they needed to get done to get the next grant. So. Thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
I hope that we as a legislature can listen to what Senator Devlin had said about this needs to keep going. There's more than a couple schools left. So.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we'll close our informational hearing on seismic retrofitting, and we'll open an informational hearing on the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. It's oftentimes really important for us to remember there are a couple of higher education systems going on in our state. One of them has to do with the public higher education system. Another has to do with independent colleges, and they have different requirements, different missions, to say, but they are a major part of contributing to the education of our kids in Oregon. So thanks for being here.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having us. My name is Thomas Helley. I live in McMinnville, Oregon. I am president of Linfield College, and I'm here today representing the 18 private nonprofit institutions of the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities. Although our colleges are individually quite diverse, The Alliance is comprised of regionally accredited nonprofit institutions of higher learning. Each is founded on and guided by a mission imbued with certain important social principles, namely that education is the key to ending poverty, fostering economic and social mobility, and that education builds community, preparing adults for lives of meaningful work and citizenship. And so I want to thank you for the opportunity to talk about independent higher education, our partnership in supporting the state's educational attainment goals, and our shared stake in the state's current and future economic and social well-being. As state policymakers, I'm sure you're hearing what public and private college and university presidents also hear from Oregon's business leaders. They urge us to graduate students who can compete in knowledge-based industries and global economies. Accordingly, our state educational attainment goals call for all Oregonians to be high school graduates, for 40% to hold associate's degrees or equivalent credentials, and for another 40% to hold bachelor's or higher degrees by the year 2025. At present, the Higher Education Coordinating Commission reports that about 35% of Oregonians ages 25 to 34 hold bachelor's or higher degrees, 5% short of the goal and 8 years away from the deadline. The Alliance has been a longtime partner in this effort to increase the educational attainment of Oregon residents. Currently, 1 in 5 undergraduate students at a four-year college or university in Oregon is enrolled at an Alliance member school. And collectively, our member schools confer 22% of the state's undergraduate degrees and nearly half of master's and doctoral degrees in the state of Oregon, something that many people don't realize. The fastest growing occupational fields, STEM professions, including health professions, demand higher levels of post-secondary education in many cases. And Alliance member colleges and universities confer significant percentages of STEM degrees. Specifically, 20% of the state's core STEM bachelor's degrees, 24% of business management and marketing bachelor's degrees in the state are conferred by our colleges, 22% of economics and political science degrees, 34% of math and statistics bachelor's degrees, 38% of education bachelor's degrees, 35% of all health professions bachelor's degrees, including 60% of all nursing degrees, and 34% of international relations bachelor's degrees. But that said, Oregon's private independent colleges and universities cost the state very little. Our schools receive no direct allocations from state coffers. The Oregon Opportunity Grant, for which we are very grateful, represents a small but very important fraction of the state's higher education resources. It's allocated, of course, directly to Oregon students who can put those resources toward their expenses at any Oregon college or university, public or private. As one who grew up on a farm and was the first in his family to go to college and went to a very small high school, it was only because of grants like this that I was able to attend a small private liberal arts college and be propelled in a career that probably wouldn't have been possible if I'd gone to a large university where I would have felt out of place. In 2016, 92% of this state's total opportunity grants went to students enrolled in public colleges and universities, but about 8% went to students enrolled at Alliance member institutions, that is, to about 2,500 students. Oregonians make up 72% of Linfield College's students. A quarter of those students rely on the Oregon Opportunity Grant to attend college. And as those are our state's most economically disadvantaged students, that support is much appreciated and very important. Our Alliance member schools seek to make opportunity grant dollars go as far as possible, of course. And we leverage them with our own institutional aid by as much as 475% in our students' educations. An August 2017 study conducted by the TIAA Research Institute for the Council of Independent Colleges showed that a bachelor's degree from a public institution is 6.4 times more costly to state taxpayers than a bachelor's degree from a private institution. For example, if the undergraduates at Alliance member schools were instead enrolled at state institutions, their undergraduate educations would cost taxpayers an additional estimated $166 million from start to finish. So, Every time an Oregon student chooses a private nonprofit institution instead of a public one, it saves the state money because that student's education is primarily paid through private college tuition and donor dollars, as opposed to state tax revenue. Now, there are a lot of myths about private higher education, and I'd like to dispel some of the most common ones. First, that we serve predominantly white institutions, or white students, from middle class and upper middle class families. The 35,000 students on our campuses today reflect a diversity of communities and experiences. That is, one-third of our students hail from demographic groups historically underrepresented on our nation's college campuses. I should also note that one in three Oregon degrees, bachelor and higher, earned by students in color, students of color, one in three of the Oregon degrees earned by students of color, and one in four STEM or health baccalaureate degrees earned by students of color are conferred by an Alliance member school. And we have the highest graduation rate in Oregon among students of color. One in five of our students is the first in their family to attend college, and one in three is eligible for federal Pell Grants. In short, our students are socially, economically, racially, and ethnically diverse. Another private college myth is that it's only available to students of significant financial means. And obviously, that can't be true if one in three of our students is Pell eligible. We serve many needy students. It is true, the advertised price, which represents the actual cost of private college, is very high. But thanks to the generosity of alumni, friends, community partners, and others, 93% of our students receive financial aid. And the average institutional grant across all Alliance schools is $20,000 per student per year. As a result, 28% of our students graduate with no debt, and the average debt load for students who do have debt is about the same as the students graduating from Oregon's public universities. But finishing college and finishing on time also has important implications for out-of-pocket cost and student debt. Currently, more than 60% of students at private independent colleges in Oregon finish their undergraduate degrees in 4 years. More than 60% in 4 years. The Higher Education Coordinating Commission currently reports that more than 60% of students at state colleges and universities take 6 years to complete their bachelor's degrees. Oregon's private colleges and universities offer a 12-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio. Our students engage in undergraduate research, internships, and other experiential learning, small classes, ready access to academic and career advising, and other educational services provide critical support and guidance to keep students on track and, as Governor Brown puts it, to graduate on time with a plan for their future. We know that every extra quarter or semester beyond 4 years that it takes a student to finish not only means additional out-of-pocket costs, tuition and fees, room and board, etc., it also means delaying entry or re-entry into the workforce and lost earnings, and that's a significant disadvantage for that student. It also means lost momentum. There's a growing national concern about student debt and how crippling that debt can be, both for those who finish college but even more for those who don't finish, who never reap the economic benefits of a post-secondary degree. Our students' loan default rates are the lowest in the state. And the fact that our default rates are collectively lower tells you something about the affordability of private college. Our graduation rates underscore our commitment to helping students finish and finish on time. And finally, Alliance schools are Oregon's longstanding economic partners, contributing $3.2 billion to the state economy each year. Collectively, we employ more than 8,800 people, more than $400 million in earnings. Our students also spend money in our local communities, an estimated $750,000 per day on lodging, transportation, and personal expenses. And our alumni love Oregon. We estimate that more than 400,000 alumni graduating from Alliance member schools, that's about half, currently live here. Our graduates embark on a variety of careers or continue their studies at graduate and professional schools or both. Among our graduates are Oregon governors and secretaries of state, chief justices of the Oregon Supreme Court, members of Congress, and the Oregon House and Senate. Our alumni teach our children, provide our health care, take care of our elders. In short, they make Oregon a better place to live. So here's what I hope you will take away today. First, that Oregon's private nonprofit colleges are longstanding partners in achieving the state's attainment and workforce goals. Second, that we prioritize access and affordability, serving a diverse array of students and delivering excellent outcomes. And third, that student success depends on finding the school that's the right fit. Different students learn differently, and student success will ultimately depend on matching students with colleges that best fit their approaches to learning. Independent colleges must continue to be among the choices available to Oregon students. And so, on behalf of my presidential colleagues, I thank you for this opportunity to speak. I'd like now to introduce Luis Perez Morales, a Linfield student, a junior who has a double major in chemistry and math and a 3.9 GPA, I discovered this afternoon, to tell you about his private college experience. And then if there's time, we'd be happy to take your questions.
Okay. Mr. Chair, committee representatives, my name is Luis Perez. I live in McMinnville, Oregon. I'd like to share with you a little bit of what I have been working on over the past 3 years. I have worked on student-faculty collaboratives research, and I have the chance to present my research on the Murdoch Science Conference this past weekend. And I'm also going to present my findings on the American Chemical Society National Meeting on Louisiana, New Orleans next year. Right now, like currently, I am the secretary for Pi Mu Epsilon, the Mathematical Honor Society on college, and well, that's everything that I wanted to say. Thank you. Actually, before my time is up, I'd like to thank the committee for supporting the Oregon Opportunity Grant, because without it, I will not be able to attend Linfield College. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take questions after. But, oh, you just.
I defer my time to Luis. So thank you, Kristen Granger, Alliance President. Mm-hmm.
And you are the president of the organization. Thank you very much for being here as well. Any questions for any of the people? I guess I will ask, is it Luis?
Yeah.
What's your, what do you anticipate doing after you get out of college?
That's an excellent question. I have two possible options. One of them is becoming an actuary, and the other one will be to go on to graduate school and earn a doctorate, PhD, or a master's degree. And I'm looking at UFO or OSU for that.
Okay. Well, thank you for being here. It's always good to hear from students, much better than all those other people. But it's nice to know that the next generation of Oregonians is using the facilities that we have here to improve their lives and the lives of their families. So thanks for being a part of it. And
Generic comment. I appreciate the independent college and university. The statistics you presented were quite astounding. We deal with the public university system over and over and over again, and the statistics that you share with regard to the impact you're having in students' lives and the cost-effective rate which you're attaining those is a great slideshow. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So we'll close our informational hearing on the Oregon Alliance of Independent Colleges and Universities, and we will open an informational hearing on revisions to the HEC strategic plan. So Ben Cannon, who works with independent colleges.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm Ben Cannon. I'm the executive director of the state's Higher Education Coordinating Commission, and here to provide a brief update on the commission, the HACS, efforts to update our strategic plan. We are in the midst of those discussions now, have been for the last several months, and will be at least through our December 14th meeting. So I figure now is a good opportunity to update you, invite your comments, feedback, invite you, of course, to participate in a commission meeting should you be so interested, in, but certainly welcome your responses today or in follow-up to today's presentation. So let me see if I can maneuver here. So strategic planning for higher education is one of the HEC statutory requirements. So ORS 350 requires us to adopt a strategic plan for achieving the state's post-secondary goals. It's one of our core statutory functions. In 2016, the commission adopted a strategic plan that looked out over the five-year time frame. I've linked to it here. That's just a snapshot of its photo. That was, in fact, the commission's second plan since it was created in 2013, but it's still operative. At the time the commission adopted that plan in 2016, it committed to an annual update, and that's what it's engaged in now. So the second link on this page is to the draft update to the 2016-2020 plan. So, and you see a snapshot. The 2016-20 plan is a sort of 40-page booklet. I've got a copy, and it's available online. The update will be a shorter sort of summary and reframing of that 2016 plan. What I'll present on today is really sort of a merger of the two, so you get a sense of where the commission is coming from. We start with a vision for Oregon higher education. It's an ambitious and aspirational one. I won't read the entirety here. This is a draft from the current update, but I will note a couple of sections. The commission envisions a future in which all Oregonians benefit from the transformational power of high-quality post-secondary education and training. It's a future where innovative colleges, universities, and training providers, both public and private, help build trajectories to family wage careers, foster a more just society, and break patterns of intergenerational poverty. It is a future where post-secondary education fuels a resilient economy, both through workforce development, meeting workforce needs, as well as through innovation, research, and knowledge, which our institutions help contribute to. Our mission is really driven by state statute, and in particular, cite here the 40-40-20 goal. I'll just note the work that you did last session in House Bill 2311 to clarify that the 40-40-20 goal, as it's been understood, applies to young adults, young Oregonians coming through our K-12 system and entering into post-secondary education and training, and that the HEC and the OIB will, in 2018, adopt goals for our working age population that will be commensurate with labor market needs and opportunities and will likely, as a result, be updated over time. And we're launching that work in December. Our strategic goals as a commission are really organized into four major categories, and the strategies really align. You'll see that in a couple of slides. Strategies align with these four categories, and each of the categories has some associated key performance measures. How often do you get to hear about key performance measures in this committee, Mr. Chair? Well, we've recently updated those with LFO and others, and are pleased that there's increasing sort of alignment between the strategies of the commission and the state and the key performance measures that we've adopted and submitted to the legislature for adoption. Student success, so that's maybe self-evident, but we understand it in terms of the percentage of Oregonians who enroll in higher education, who make progress through higher education, so for example, by earning college credits in K-12, that's one of our measures of progress, who complete their certificates and degrees or transfer, in the case of many community college students who transfer to another institution before completing, and so things like time to completion, the graduation rates of our institutions factor into our measures of success, student success, and finally, overall educational attainment along the lines of 40-40-20, what percentage of a given population has earned certificates and degrees. So that's sort of the student success-related efforts and how we think about those. Equity is essentially all of those and other measures disaggregated by race and ethnicity and for our low-income students to ensure that we are achieving these goals equitably, and strategies in that bucket are really linked to the need to meet the equity imperative. Affordability, there's a single measure that we've that the legislature has adopted, key performance measure nine, but it's really an effort to understand how many Oregonians are experiencing unaffordable costs in higher education. The majority is the short answer, and then to organize strategies around improving that. We'll get to them in a minute. And finally, economic and community impact, sort of the fourth major category of work, and we have ways of measuring that that include earnings for graduates, how well they're succeeding in the in employment. How will we influence outcomes? So this is a place where I think it's sort of the hardest place for a commission like ours to go. It's one thing to set up goals and come up with exciting strategies. It's another thing for those to really be linked to our authorities and our responsibilities and our opportunities as a commission and as an agency. And so we really, as you know, we're not a governing board. We don't run the institutions, but we do have certain kinds of authorities and responsibilities for coordination, for budget development, for reporting. And those are reflected in these sort of four areas of effort where we think we can help influence the outcomes on the prior slide. So through, for example, reporting, and I'll say more in the next slide, through funding, through our budget development, through not only how much we recommend funding, but how we allocate that funding to institutions, through developing clear, more streamlined learner pathways from high school to college to degree into the workforce, and finally, through expanding opportunity to post-secondary education by outreaching to more Oregonians to engage them in education and training. And so to get a sense of what that looks like, and there's a lot on this slide, and this is actually the last slide in my presentation, this starts to sort of populate a grid with those four activities that I just described along the top. Those are the columns and the four major areas of goals along the left side. So you start to line that up and then put specific strategies within each of the boxes here. So for example, starting in the top left, thinking about our responsibility for reporting and our goal of student success, we are in the process of developing a single-page institutional and regional profiles so that policymakers, institutional leaders, the public will quickly understand how well their region or their institution is doing relative to student success goals. We likewise and separately have responsibility every other year for evaluating the effectiveness of our public universities. So that's another area of opportunity for us to use our reporting and evaluation responsibility to help influence student success. Can sort of go down the list. I won't read every piece of this slide, but to take the same category of reporting, thinking about equity, well, we again have can use our reporting levers to disaggregate data, help policymakers, help institutions, help the public understand where those gaps are, and hopefully then design strategies to address them. Thinking about the funding category, a lot of emphasis on the commission in terms of our responsibility for funding, and our responsibility, it's actually in statute, it's also on this slide, is to bring to you and to the public a comprehensive strategic funding plan for higher education to meet the state goals. And so the development of our budget request to the governor and to the legislature will reflect what our commission determines is the need in order to meet the state goals. We will simultaneously be presenting on how that those dollars need to be administered, need to be allocated in order to most effectively reach the state goals. So there's a significant piece of work for our commission and its staff around presenting, developing and presenting a strategic budget and funding plan. When you think about equity, one of the things that I'm proud that our commission has done in terms of funding and equity is to weight underrepresented students in our funding formula for our distribution of university funds. And until 2015, there was no weighting within the fund. So you're well aware of the ways in which the K-12 fund, for example, that the legislature administers, the K-12 formula weights underrepresented groups. In order to reflect, in part, the higher costs of educating low-income students, et cetera. Our formula for public universities now does something very similar for rural students, for low-income students, for students of color, for veteran students. It provides greater funding weights to institutions that are serving greater percentages of those students. And that's one way we can drive sort of towards our equity goals through our funding allocation responsibilities. the HEC, thinking about affordability and funding. The HEC administers the Oregon Promise and the Oregon Opportunity Grant, as well as other state and federal aid programs, financial aid programs. And we can use both our administrative authority as well as our policy leadership authority to help shape those programs and administer those programs in ways that most effectively meet students' needs and improve affordability. Obviously, when it comes to the Promise and the Opportunity Grant, that's involves a conversation with you, one that is ongoing, as we attempt to understand what's working, what's not, what we'd like to be working better, what the true needs are in terms of funding those programs or others to achieve greater levels of affordability in higher education for Oregon residents. Finally, on the funding category, I do want to emphasize the economic and community impact opportunities here. Again, when we overhauled the university funding formula, we added funding weights to reflect higher demand areas of study. So, for example, a graduate who is in a STEM field or bilingual teachers, because of the high needs in both of those areas within our economy, we weight the funding allocation associated with those degrees, and there will be continued opportunity for the commission to consider what are those areas and how do we allocate funding to better create incentives and supports for institutions to build graduates in those degrees. Pathways, a lot of work underway here, including work that this committee has helped to oversee. One of the significant pieces of responsibility for the commission after the last legislative session was the implementation with the colleges and universities of the transfer legislation that attempts to smooth the transfer process for community college students transferring to four-year universities. So that's cited here. We have other work underway related to building pathways from CTE programs, whether those are high school or community college-based, or apprenticeship to certificate or degree. Likewise, see opportunities here to build better pathways into between educational experiences and work. Finally, around outreach, we're doing a certain amount of outreach directly to Oregonians today. Note on the slide here the Aspire work that through our Office of Student Access and Completion, we lead we support in high schools and middle schools throughout the state. But we're only touching a fraction of Oregon students, putting them in contact with a volunteer mentor and helping coach them and support them in their post-secondary aspirations. But there's, I think, tremendous opportunity to build that or related programs, including ones potentially for adults. We likewise have significantly ramped up the state's work in supporting FAFSA completion efforts. This, of course, is the application that a student has to do to receive federal financial aid. It is likewise a requirement for state financial aid unless the student qualifies for our state-based version, the ORSA. And we, while we've seen big, impressive gains in the percentage of Oregon students, high school students in particular, who are completing FAFSAs and getting Pell Grants or state funding for college, we're still sort of middle of the pack nationally. And so with partner organizations, see major opportunities here to continue to build the on the number of Oregonians who are accessing both state and federal aid through FAFSA and ORSA completion efforts. Finally, economic and community impact. We do have a workforce office that we share with the employment department, and incorporating the avenues for post-secondary training that Oregonians have via apprenticeship, via workforce training, using GI Bill benefits, whether at public or private institutions, private career schools, some of which can lead to quite meaningful careers. Is an area of real opportunity, I think, for us to take advantage of our coordinating responsibilities and our outreach opportunities to better connect Oregonians with post-secondary education and training. So with that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll conclude my presentation. This, again, is just a snapshot of some of the strategies that we have underway and, most importantly, sort of the framework that we're using to guide our work on strategically coordinating Oregon post-secondary education. Thanks.
Thank you. Any questions for Ben? I just appreciate the fact that you are keeping us updated and you keep moving forward. So thank you for that. We'll probably have you back multiple times to find out what's going on and see the kind of progress that you're making, but I appreciate it. Yes, Senator Hatch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the metrics and the sort of how you're building a sort of a web of metrics on that, plan. I think it's sophisticated and necessary, kind of what the doctor ordered for higher ed.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And thank right you. On time. So I'm impressed with all of the first three groups. With that, we'll close our hearing on the HEC strategic plan, and we're going to open an informational hearing on the Institute report on high school athletic safety. Corey Singer, Dr. Michael Keister, Dr. Sam Johnson, and Dr. Melissa McCourt. Come on up. And if we can get three chairs will work. So again, thank you for being here. It's something that we do care about. There's another group in the health committee that's really working on some legislation down the road. But we like to keep on top of what's going on with regard to student health and making sure that our athletes are taken care of as they proceed through the whole system. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee for inviting us. I'm Michael Keister. I am currently the chair of the OSAA Sports Medicine Advisory Committee, and I hold the same position nationally for the National Federation of High Schools. I'm a sports medicine physician practicing in Eugene. It's often that it seems that sports medicine related and health and safety issues come up regarding high school athletes in these chambers. So we really wanted to give you an overview of what the OSAA does and some of the things that we're looking forward to in the future. So the OSAA really focuses on student health and safety issues as as our sports medicine advisory committee. We were the nation's first committee to discuss these issues, and now all states have a committee. And we're really seen as national leaders throughout high school sports when we talk to folks from other states. And we have been involved in everything that's written out there in front of you is just a little sampling of what we've done over the years. I did not expect that. Okay. Sports physical law was several years ago, and we continue to update that form. One of the most recent things was the fall practice changes in football of lessening contact, and several states followed that as well. Most recently, revisions in the sports physical form, and we've collaborated with the OHA on that, and we look forward to some other collaborations that we're currently looking at with them. Also wanted to give you an overview of coach education and what's expected. Now, some of these things have been mandated by the legislature, the concussion recognition and management. Annually, coaches undergo that training. And the anabolic steroids, or APEDs, which is appearance and performance enhancing drugs and substances, that training is every 4 years. The other training that you see up there has been mandated by the OSAA, and so this applies to the coaches. As said, for Federation, heat illness prevention is something that all coaches undergo. The heads-up football certification is just football coaches, and then cheerleading coaches have to go through a safety education as well. There's certainly barriers to risk minimization in our schools, and many of them are similar to some of the things that have already been discussed on other avenues. And one of those is that we have a lot of small schools and really asking a lot from those people in those schools. So over 90 high schools in Oregon have less than 120 students. As a graduate of one of those high schools, I can appreciate that. And many are geographically isolated as well, so they don't have access to particularly a great deal of healthcare professionals in those areas. An increasing thing that we see is many of the coaches aren't teachers. We're really drawing more and more from the private sector, traditionally thinking of coaches in the building of being the ones who are coaching. Those teachers just doesn't happen as much anymore, and they don't have an understanding always of the educational model and the importance in high school athletics. And of course, certainly we see a rapid turnover in coaches and athletic directors, and that's often at those rural schools as well. And that's partially because those are kind of high stress jobs, and a lot of expected from those folks. Time clearly is for all of us. Multiple issues to deal with already: coaches, parents, scheduling, other issues. Costs. Often there's other budget priorities, and those things where we're looking off into the future of trying to prevent problems aren't always at the foremost of our mind. And again, I already mentioned about the available professionals, and then understanding relevance and prioritizing and why in the case of of catastrophic events, why are rare occurrences something that we need to plan for? One of the things that you mentioned and one of the things that we were invited for to discuss was this Corey Stringer Institute report. This came out several months ago. Corey Stringer Institute is an advocacy and research group in Connecticut. It's named after Corey Stringer, who was a professional football player who died from a heat-related illness. And this group has put a great deal of emphasis on looking at what schools and states are doing throughout the nation on prevention issues, particularly around this focus on head, which is concussion, heat illness, and heart, which is cardiovascular conditions, typically those that lead to sudden death. We had some concerns about this report when it came out, and I know that we tried to get information out to folks as much as possible because we didn't really know how it was going to be released. The concern was with the weighting and the priorities that they had. It wasn't evidence-based, and many of the weighting and the interventions was somewhat arbitrary. Regardless, Oregon ended up ranked 15th out of all the states and District of Columbia. However, we don't really take that as a compliment as much as really looking at that report, but also looking at other factors and seeing what we can do to improve moving forward. So again, if you hear about this report, if you see of it, we were ranked higher than many other states, but that certainly doesn't mean that we're going to rest upon that, and there's still much work to be done. So where do we focus our time on the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee? This is a group of folks, probably 15 physicians, athletic trainers. We also have representatives from the Athletic Directors and the Coaches Association, plus OSAA staff. We meet 4 times a year, and there's much work to be done between those meetings, and we're all volunteers. Concussion on the field and in the classroom obviously has been a big issue, and it's not just a sports issue. It's an academic issue as well, because all of these kids have the job of being in school. We talk about emergency action planning and how that relates to any issue, whether it's a condition of a head injury or a sudden cardiac arrest or other heart-related issues. We talk about medical coverage for events, athletic trainers being the primary sources of coverage in those areas, and just multiple risk minimization issues and anything else that arises, such as mumps outbreaks and state wrestling tournaments and other issues, and smoke. This is one of the big issues that I think the role of the OSAA really came to the forefront this fall, when it wasn't just sports teams, but schools asking about PE participation and what kids should be doing outside when many of us were being inundated by smoke. The bottom picture there is my backyard at the beginning of September, which we usually can see much further than that. So there weren't a lot of guidelines available, and the OSAA really put out a lot of information. And one of the key things that the OSAA has is a reach to be able to communicate information to all the schools, particularly the high schools, in an easy manner. Moving forward, we will continue to work with the OHA on doing more interagency collaboration and also working with other states, namely Montana, to put together even better guidelines. But this was a good example of the work that we do. Future of health and safety in high school athletes. What more can we do to break down those barriers previously mentioned? We continue to inform our schools and develop policies on best practices and risk minimization. This isn't something that we're doing just at the state level, but really try and do it collaboratively with other states across the nation. Being in the position that I am nationally gives me a good opportunity to see what other people are doing in other states, and we can share ideas and failures and successes. We really look more and more at athletic trainers in the majority of our high schools would be our goal. Sam's going to speak to that a little bit in a little bit. The cost barrier is obviously a big thing, and that's something that we're working on as a group to try and look and see whether there are some cost savings potentially for the state, for looking at Medicaid funds of that, of how can athletic trainers save money by preventing injury and addressing injuries that don't have to go to the emergency department or to urgent care. We've also even looked at things such as identifying an athletic safety officer at the school level. One of the things that we find is that, again, I talked about those barriers, athletic directors being overwhelmed. And sometimes they really don't feel empowered to make what are often health and safety decisions. And this wouldn't be a concept of creating a new position, but just giving whether that person was the risk management officer, if that person was an athletic director, a school nurse, an athletic trainer, someone within that school district or school building, empowering them and further educating them to make some of these decisions that can be done at a local level. So with my conclusions here, again, everyone dealing with young athletes, we need to have them be aware of the risks of injury and the risks of participation, but be well advised that those do not outweigh the great benefits that we see both health-wise and even academically by participation in high school sports. Coach education is a must. We've showed you that previous slide, and we'll continue to adjust that over time. And, of course, parent and athlete education is evolving, and we try to get that out as much as possible. Everyone needs to know their role from a communication standpoint and really mandates and legislation. We've seen a little bit more of a push in many states of legislating high school safety issues, and we like to think that that's not always necessary, that we can get schools to comply with many of these issues without having to take the step of legislation. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithcomb, thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to present on this important topic of youth sports safety and the role of certified athletic trainers, the role they play in these efforts. My name is Sam Johnson. I'm a faculty member in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences at Oregon State University, and I'm also representing the Oregon Athletic Trainers Society. So athletic trainers are healthcare professionals that prevent, evaluate, treat, and rehabilitate injuries and medical conditions. Athletic trainers are required to be certified nationally by the Board of Certification for the Athletic Trainer and registered as an athletic trainer by the State of Oregon's Health Licensing Office. Starting in 2022, all entry-level AT education will occur at the master's level. ATs collaborate closely with other healthcare professionals, including primary care physicians such as Dr. Keister, local EMS, school nurses, and more and more with the OSA and OHA on different topics we're interested in. ATs are specifically trained to provide sports-related preventative services. We have a study, for example, here in Oregon that showed that schools that had an athletic trainer were more likely to have emergency action plans in place versus schools that did not have athletic trainers. This type of planning can prevent and hopefully minimize costly catastrophic injuries. In terms of injury evaluation, ATs in collaboration with physicians can determine if injuries need immediate referral for more advanced care. For example, an athletic trainer who evaluates a student athlete's sprained ankle may be able to determine whether an athlete needs to seek further care at the emergency department or can be treated at the school, which potentially could save over $1,000 per visit. Schools who have an athlete, there's been a recent study that showed that schools that have an athlete trainer have a greater number of diagnosed concussions than schools without. This is actually a positive thing. What it shows is that these we're identifying and getting these student athletes who've suffered concussions into proper management earlier. Additionally, as Dr. McCart will talk about, athletic trainers can play a role in the important concept of returning the athlete to learning, not just returning to participation. When injuries do occur, many of those injuries can be treated on campus, which will prevent the student athlete from having to leave campus to go to an appointment off campus. So that allows them to stay in school and not miss class. Additionally, for long-term injuries such as surgeries where the athlete needs to go through rehabilitation, the athlete trainer can provide adjunct care working in collaboration with the physical therapist that can extend the number of visits that the athlete will be able to see. In the bigger picture, we really are thinking about, our research group is thinking about athletic training in the bigger public health arena. And so when we look at public health, you know, some of the key concepts are greater utilization. Student athletes at schools that have services and athletic training available are able to have access to a healthcare provider on campus every day without any cost to them or their parents. Potential cost savings, as noted earlier, ATs may be able to prevent unnecessary emergency department visits and may save money with catastrophic injuries. Our research group is also at OSU is looking at the Oregon All Payers All Claims data set and looking at cost effectiveness of athletic trainers. We are preparing a publication for a study that shows this shows promising results on AT return on investment for Medicaid. Lastly, with better care. Unfortunately, when an athletic trainer isn't available, the coaches and administrators will bear the responsibility to treat these injuries. And so we think it provides better health care for the student athletes in Oregon to have access to athletic trainers and other healthcare professionals on campus. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Dr. McHart from the Center on Brain Injury Research and Training. And my role in all of this injury piece that they're talking about and with the athletic trainers is really around returning students to school and not just play. And so one of the things we have in place in our state, unlike all but one other state, is we have what we call the Oregon TBI teams. And I oversee those teams for the state. And what we have is a group of over 400 people who are trained to assist students who've been injured, not just on the athletic fields, but car crashes, any other kind of accidents, in returning to the school setting. And not just the classroom, but the entire school setting, which can be very challenging for a student who has a brain injury or an injury of some kind. We also work closely with many experts in the state as part of the Oregon Concussion Management Program. We also call it OCAMP for short. Dr. Keister is on that team as well. And we focus on helping students return to play and return to school. So one of the things I wanted to touch on briefly is across the nation, we have this buzzword kind of thing happening around return to learn, and we have many states passing legislation requiring schools to have processes for returning students who've been concussed to the classroom settings. And I just wanted to talk a little bit about what that is and give folks some information. So really, the Oregon TBI teams and OCAMP and folks across the nation are identifying return to learn as more of a process where we have a step-by-step systematic approach for screening to see if students on and off the field have received concussions. Our athletic trainers do a fantastic job of catching our students who have sports injuries, but as we know, that's a small percentage of the students that are coming back to school with head injuries. And so we're looking at, in return to learn, a process for screening these kids and identifying them, and then hopefully putting into place what we in Oregon like to call an ITAP, immediate temporary accommodation plan, because we know that we have processes for helping students who have longer term injuries, say the 504 process or the IEP process, but many of the students who receive head injuries, they recover somewhere between, you know, a few weeks to a few months. But within that window of time, they're at great, great risk for academic failure. And so we're trying to put in place temporary accommodations immediately to intervene in that risk and keep them on what a great trajectory most of them are for college and career readiness, and without allowing them to have that window of failure that just takes them off track. So within return to learn, after that, we're looking at monitoring, because we know while most of the kids get better, not all of them do. And so we need to look at that trajectory of recovery and continuously change their accommodation plans to meet them where they're at, as well as monitor them in case they need further assistance, for example, like a 504 plan or an IEP, or looking at when do we drop their immediate accommodations. And so that is really my area of focus within this mix of folks, and there's just a lot happening across the nation in return to learn, and I thought I'd share a little bit of information around that.
No, and that's very helpful. It's kind of funny, when we started this whole concussion issue, we really focused on recognition, getting them off the field, and then deciding when they were going to be able to go back to play safely, and then it kind of struck all of us a few years down the road of, hey, they need to go to school.
They go back to the classroom first.
So it's been a little bit behind on this, but I think it's really coming into the force, so it's been a great experience. We also have with us, he didn't get a chair, Mr. Peter Weber, who is the executive director of the OSAA, and I can't thank Peter and his staff enough for the support and the respect and the latitude that they give the Sports Medicine Advisory Committee. It's been very helpful. So we're open for questions if there's time.
Any questions? I guess the one that I appreciate, and I can appreciate Mr. Weber including, is that we have many, many more students that come to our schools every year who have chronic diseases and other kinds of problems, whether it be diabetes or others. And it used to be that parents and others just said, oh, they can just do the classwork and come home. They don't need to be involved in athletics. And we all know that athletics are a big part of training and learning for all kids. And more of those kids are now finding ways to be active participants in athletics. And it is our community of medical people and OSA that acknowledge that they should have that opportunity. And athletic trainers, better than others, when you don't have athletic trainers, it is much harder being from some of the small schools. But physicians are getting better at trying to figure out ways to accommodate that, to make sure that the coaches and other people around them understand what they should or should not do. And we've had a number of bills here in the last couple of years that deal with some very, very rare kinds of disease and the kinds of interventions that need to happen in schools. And I think we're getting better at helping kids have those experiences. And I know that Senator Monson-Anderson is having the concussion conversation in health where it should be, and I look forward to seeing what she comes out of that. And I appreciate the work that's being done on developing better resources and training for everybody to start identifying concussions, because I believe it's true that we've had a number of kids who have been concussed, and they weren't known at the time, and they didn't necessarily happen at school. I mean, happened on the playground. And it did affect their learning, and no one caught the signs that the reason that they all of a sudden started not doing so well was because their brain wasn't working as well. And I hopefully all of this will help make that experience for every kid better. So I thank you. I don't know if there's any other comments, but thanks for being here, and thanks for sharing the information with us. And I appreciated the stuff on athletic trainers. I have a sister-in-law who was an athletic trainer. Now she's elementary PE, but she uses those skills in what she does. And she always was frustrated by the fact that you get this degree and then you don't get to participate because most schools aren't hiring athletic trainers. They're getting a little bit better at that, but thank you.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Weber, do you want to say anything? Okay, we're good. Thank you very much for being here. So we'll close our informational hearing on the Corey Singer Institute report on higher high school athletics staff safety. And we will open an informational hearing on Oregon State University expansion. Is Tim here? Yeah, there you are. Yeah, your hair is different. He's whatever. I'll let Tim start, and then we'll have Becky Johnson, Scott Allen, Melanie Wade-Whitmer, and Leanna Fredrickson come on up afterwards.
Thank you.
You have a big team behind you.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, and Vice Chair Linthicum, and member of the committee currently.
That's right.
I'm State Senator Tim Canope from Bend, representing Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And we are before you today to talk about the OSU Cascades expansion project, and that it's going well, but we need some funding. So there'll be a funding request for bonding. We received about $9 million worth of bonding in the long session, but it is necessary for a couple of reasons. One is timing, and two is the fact that we actually have a need for capacity at OSU Cascades. And it has been a great opportunity for Central Oregon to have higher ed on the ground and available to students. And you'll hear from a couple students today, as well as a business owner who has benefited greatly from the university being there, as well as you'll hear from our president of the university. And it has been both a benefit in terms of education and having equity and able to have higher ed in Central Oregon, but also in terms of economics as well. And so I just want to let you know that we appreciate the opportunity to present today and look forward to a request in the short session. Thank you.
So just so you know, there was a senator earlier that I gave the – I made a mistake and told him he could talk about anything he wanted. And he did pick out this one thing to talk about and expressed as a leaving co-chair of Ways and Means that it would be a really good thing to do. So you did have someone that followed you before.
How nice.
Who said that yes. We made the decision about whether this should be a campus a long time ago. We need to make sure that it gets done. So I was pleased to hear that on his way out. He said he was trying to be exciting for a change.
Oh, that's great.
For a change.
Yeah. So you were preceded by another senator who agrees with you.
Well, thank you.
Yep. So with that, thank you for being. Any questions for Senator Canoe? No one wants to grill him. Okay. With that, however they want to bring themselves up, we have this group that's traveled a long ways. You're going to come in waves.
We'll come in twos.
In two waves, okay, that's good. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, Senator Gelser. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today. I'm Becky Johnson, Vice President for OSU Cascades, and I'm really honored to have two students with me today and a member of our business community who have taken the entire day to travel here to Salem, testify before your committee. And I assure you, I won't penalize the students for missing classes today.
Okay.
We're here to ask for your support for the expansion of OSU Cascades, and in particular for $39 million in state bonds that will fund our next academic building on the campus. In the 2017 session, we asked for $69.5 million, which would have funded the entire expansion of the campus. And we received $9.5 million, and we were very appreciative for the legislature's appropriation because it does allow us to get started on the site preparation for the next building, but obviously it doesn't fund the building, and the building is what we need to be able to meet our growing enrollment and not come up on a cap in terms of capacity. I have a couple of slides, and they're very simple, just to show you about the need for expansion at OSU Cascades. And the first is just a slide about, okay, that's not the one. This shows our projected headcount. I was just going to show you a slide that demonstrated the population growth in Central Oregon as compared to the rest of the state. And I'm sure you all have heard that population is growing very quickly in Central Oregon. But not only is it the fastest growing region in Oregon, but the Bend-Redmond MSA was the third fastest growing MSA in the entire country last year. Even tiny Crook County was the eighth fastest growing county in the country last year. So Central Oregon is outpacing the state in terms of population growth. And a lot of people think of Central Oregon as a place where tourists and retirees come to live and stay for a few days. And that's true. We are a destination for tourists and retirees. But we have a very booming K-12 enrollment. And Bend Lapine and the Redmond School Districts have been the fastest growing among metro districts since 2004. So this is the population. The orange is the Central Oregon. And Central Oregon is just three counties. It's Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County. And so those three counties are growing at a much faster rate. And then, let's see, I think I have control there. This shows the district enrollment at metro districts. And Bend Lapine and the Redmond school districts have been growing at quite a fast rate since 2004. So we have a big pipeline of high school graduates that will be coming through our system looking for opportunities for higher education. So no other university, public or private, is in Central Oregon, and the nearest university is actually OSU in Corvallis. And so a study from the American Council on Education showed that 57% of freshmen who go to a public university go to a university within 50 miles of their permanent home. And this need for proximity is especially great for rural students, first-generation students, underrepresented students. And we are serving exactly those kinds of students at OSU Cascades. 67% of our students are from this tri-county region. 32% of them are first-generation, 16% are U.S. minorities, and 52% are Pell Grant eligible, meaning that they have great financial need. So the population and the enrollment in our K-12 system isn't expected to slow in the foreseeable future. So in order to provide the educational access to that growing population, OSU Cascades needs to expand. So I'm asking for your support for $39 million so we can fund that next building, our next academic building at OSU Cascades. And thank you again for allowing us to testify, and I'll turn it over to one of our private sector partners, Scott Allen.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Linthicum, Senator Gelser. I'm Scott Allen. I'm the Global General Manager of Hydro Flask, based in Bend, Oregon, and I'm here to support
and thank you for allowing me to testify on behalf of OSU Cascades. Hydro Flask, like OSU Cascades, is a young, fast-growing, dynamic entity. In the 5.5 years since I joined the company first as president and CEO, we've grown from $3 million to over $100 million in revenue, from 12 people to about 80 people, mostly in Bend, Oregon, some in Portland, and three in Switzerland for whatever that's worth. And we've grown to become the number one water bottle brand in the United States outdoor and natural foods market, displacing a brand to the state south of us in the meantime. Part of our success in growing the company has been the need for access to a trained workforce. And we've hired from across the state, obviously, University of Oregon, Oregon State and Corvallis, Portland State. We've worked with those universities and some of their programs specific to our outdoor products industry. But recently, it's been increasingly important for us to partner with the university to do capstone projects, to provide internships, which lead to part-time jobs, which lead to full-time employment with a trained workforce that comes in and supports us. Bend is an exciting place. We're just one of the companies there that are growing quickly. We have dozens in the outdoor sector. There's others in the tech sector and green technology sector as well. We have the first outdoor products incubator that formed in Bend, Oregon, the first kind of outdoor venture conference that happened in Bend, Oregon. And it's certainly a place that we're excited about. Last year, the company Hydro Flask was acquired by a large conglomerate brand holding company. They're leaving us in Bend, which is great, and letting me run the business. Part of what we did, the prior ownership group, myself, was to invest $350,000 into OSU Cascades to create an outdoor products degree program, with the idea being to create future Hydro Flasks, to provide a workforce that could be, you know, trained and come right into our industry, and to kind of give back to the state as an investment in the future. On behalf of the industry in Bend, we're ready for this workforce. We're growing quickly. We look to the university to help provide some of these needs, and I thank you for your support.
Invite our students.
Do you have any samples of your work?
Yeah, I just have my personal model here.
Just want to make sure. You get here, you might as well be able to do a little bit. So,
appreciate the question.
I thought you were violating protocol and wanted to, you know.
Oh, no. Just wanted to make sure he pointed out that sitting next to him was important product. So thank you. But isn't Eastern right next door? Eastern Oregon, you know.
Eastern Oregon is actually one of the farther universities from OSU Cascades.
We sometimes forget that the east side is fairly large in comparison to the west side. So.
Indeed.
Thank you. I'll ask our two students to come up and join.
Yep, that'd be great. And thanks for taking time out of your day to make the trip.
Thank you for having us here.
Yeah. Yes. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Melanie Widmer. I'm here also to ask for your support for additional funding of $39 million to fund the expansion of OSU Cascades. I'm the owner and president of Madras Sanitary Service, a garbage and recycling company. I'm also the former mayor of Madras. And at 44 years old, I'm a senior at OSU Cascades. So I'm on the better late than never track because living in Central Oregon, when I was college age, there was no university I could get to. I grew up in Madras, and after graduating from high school, I was able to attend Central Oregon Community College. I also worked in our family business, Madras Sanitary, while making the two-hour round-trip commute to COCC for classes. By the time I received my associate's degree, about 20 years ago, both my husband and I were working in our business, and moving away for additional education was out of the question. At the time, the closest university to Madras was in Portland, over 120 miles and a mountain range away. I was needed in my family business, so any further education I could get would have to be within commuting distance. At the time, there was no such place. I was placed bound by my business, just as thousands of other potential students are placed bound for all kinds of reasons. Studies show, as Dr. Johnson mentioned, that a large percentage of young people won't attend college at all if there isn't one within 50 miles of home. That clearly seems to have been the case in Jefferson County, where only 16% of our adult population has a bachelor's degree or higher. particularly in families without a lot of resources or a college tradition, moving away from the support system can be an insurmountable hurdle. Distance was a deal breaker for me, as it was for so many of my peers. Then finally, OSU Cascades was born in Central Oregon. So in 2014, I went back to school, taking my first several classes at COCC through OSU Cascades 2+2 partnership model with the community college. Even though I was at that point decades into my career and had served several years on my city council and then as mayor, I never lost the sense of regret at not having been able to obtain the level of education I wanted and needed. My years at OSU Cascades have filled in so many of my skills gaps in accounting, management, marketing, and finance. I've also learned so much that I didn't even realize I was missing. I'm grateful every day to have this opportunity. OSU Cascades is now serving the higher education needs of the most underserved area of Oregon. Because of all the pent-up demand, the school is growing rapidly. If we don't act now to add additional capacity, we will very soon run out of space. My generation of Central Oregonians missed out on opportunities because there was no university nearby. This generation may miss opportunities because of a lack of investment. Please invest in OSU Cascades and help us catch up with the rest of our state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Roblin, Vice Chair Lithicum, and Senator Gelser, my name is Linnea Fredrickson, and I'm a junior at OSU Cascades. I want to thank you for your time for having us testify here. And today I'll be sharing a little bit of my story and expressing how important OSU Cascades is to me. I was born in Deschutes County in 1997 and grew up in Redmond, Oregon with my father, where I attended Tumalo Community School and Mountain View High School. And I personally experienced one-on-one interaction between my teachers and with me, and that impacted me so much that I wanted to be a teacher when I grew up. But my father had other ideas for me and wanted me to become a lawyer. And while I was in high school, when I was 16, I applied to Southern Methodist University's pre-law program, and I was accepted into the program. I was ready to go on to higher education and leave Oregon as a whole to go on to college. But then a month before high school graduation, my grandfather passed away, and my 88-year-old grandma asked me to stay with her, to be close. And I said yes, and I changed my plans and had to quickly decide whether I should continue on and get a bachelor's degree or just work full-time. And luckily, OSU Cascades is right around the corner for me to look at, and I applied for the school and got in. That fall of 2015, I walked into Cascades Hall with 50 other first-year full-time students that would be getting their bachelor's degree in Central Oregon through OSU Cascades. And while I wasn't sure of my whole entire process there, knowing that I wanted to be at another university, I persisted on. And that winter, I signed up for a public speaking class with one of our outstanding faculty members. And thanks to our small class sizes, he noticed how interested I was in the subject, and he gave me the opportunity to explore the field. And now today I'm 20 years old, and my aspiring goal is to be a doctorate in speech communication and teach at the collegiate level. Without OSU Cascades, I wouldn't have been able to come to this decision or even notice it as a whole. And thanks to the small class sizes and devoted faculty, I was given even a better opportunity, just like I was in elementary school and high school throughout my whole entire career, that helped me realize that I am a student and I can do the best that I can with every single effort that I put in. With Central Oregon as a whole, we are booming. It's crazy to consider about all the high school kids that are currently in school looking forward to going to college. And one important thing for me is I grew up with the dream of going to college, and a lot of high school seniors right now have that dream too, but they have to go elsewhere to go to get that dream. They can't go 20 minutes and drive over to OSU Cascades and take classes like I can. So with this expansion, it's so important for us to grow as a campus so we can accommodate for all of these new students that we have, because if not, they can have the same options as me as to either leave the state or just decide not to go to college as a whole. So I hope that you really consider this $39 million fund to help us expand the school, because not only will it help Central Oregon as a whole, it will help the state altogether. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? I guess I have one. So is your dad happy with you changing from lawyer to speech doctor?
Not exactly. It wasn't until I actually participated in the Circle of Excellence philanthropic event where I invited my father, where he noticed that I really enjoyed this. That's and after that, he was like, okay.
That's really nice. And the 125 miles you've forgot to mention that there's some mountains in between. So, you know, we have 125 miles from Coos Bay to Eugene to our nearest college, but not as much snow on the
That's
way,
true.
ice or other kinds of impediments along the way here. So it's a big commitment if you're going to go outside of there. So other students that you know have that have made the decision to go to Cascades rather than just getting a job and working?
Yes, I know, because I graduated in 2015 and I'm heavily still involved with Mountain View High School, one of the growing populations there. A lot of them decided to go to OSU Cascades instead because of the small class sizes and faculty involvement within students. And not only that, we have an awesome word-of-mouth opportunity at our school with all of our students. It'd be so hard to go to campus and find a student that wasn't excited about one class or wasn't super involved in one part. Because we are such a small school, there's so much opportunities to work with Hydro Flask, to get internships, to do anything. People become motivated and passionate about it, and you can see it everywhere.
Thank you. Any other questions? I appreciate your enthusiasm, both of you, and I really appreciate the fact that you decided to finish the course you set so many years ago to get a degree, because that's not something we think about all the time, and we really do need to have a conversation with each other, because there's a lot of people like you out there that put off their decisions. So thank you for coming all this way. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So with that, we will close our informational hearing on Oregon State University expansion. Again, I thank everybody for really keeping on their time schedule. And we're going to open an informational hearing on College Possible. The other program, so Julia and crew can come on up. The other program that our good senator, who was given the permission to say whatever he wanted to when he was testifying in the first one, said, you've really got to look at this program. It's really good. So Senator, our good co-chair of Ways and Means, threw in a good word for you guys as well in that opening statement that we gave him. So thank you for being here.
Thank him for that. Good afternoon, Chairman Roveland and members of the committee. My name is Julie Mancini, and I'm the executive director of College Possible. I want to start with two things. One, I think I'm a little overwhelmed by how difficult your job must be, because what you do is hear constantly from people in the state who are in need of something. I want to thank you for that work. And second, I don't think I should ever follow a student and a business owner when it comes to testifying. I'm sort of humbled to be here today, a little anxious because I've never done this before, and I'd like to give you a small update on College Possible. In the interest of time, I won't go into detail, but you can refer to the state report card we submitted that highlights the details of our program and the results of the state investment in our program, and that was sent to you earlier. Also, I want to thank you and the members of the legislature for including us for state support that we have received in the last two biennium budgets. Because of your support, state support, we've been able to grow the number of students we serve, adding new schools in the East County of Portland, and we are in six high schools surrounding to the east of Portland. Your support also allowed us to start a new rural program serving students in Eastern Oregon and Northwest, and sort of up Route 30, Northwest Oregon. We are present in the high schools, sometimes tech connected, sometimes with a coach driving out to Eastern Oregon. We are present in the high schools of Umatilla, McLaughlin, Riverside, Irrigan. Did I say that? Mm-hmm. And in the Northwest, going up Route 30, Rainier, St. Helens, Gaston, and Clatskanie. You will hear more about that in Casey's testimony. College Possible is a college access program that works with high school juniors and seniors in a near-peer coaching model. We use AmeriCorps recent graduates who are their coaches and are in the schools 4 days a week, and then continues to support our students up to 6 years to be able to complete a BA within the 6 years. With me today is John Beyer, principal of David Douglas High School, which was sort of our beginning high school. Gia Dakayanan is a graduate of Gresham High School and is now a student across the street at Willamette University. And Casey Block is one of four program coordinators that we have on staff that work with our coaches for our three programs, the high school coaching, the college coaching, which is tech connected, and the coaching of students in the rural areas. We look forward to working with the state again to continue our growth, and thank you for everything you've done up till this time. We'd like to take questions at the end, but I'm going to give my seat to John right now. Thank you.
So you're from the smallest high school in Oregon, David Douglas, right?
Yeah.
Well, I was glad to hear from the folks from Eastern Oregon, because that's where initially I grew up.
That's right.
And, that's good. So, Mr. That's Chair,
amazing school. Yep.
Members of the of the committee, I'm honored to speak with you today. I'm John Beyer. I'm the principal of David Douglas High School. And again, I'm honored to be chosen by College Possible today to talk with them a little bit. We were the first high school in the state to take them on, and it's been a wonderful relationship. And I'd like to start just by saying that I became principal of the high school 10 years ago, and it didn't take very long to find that there was a certain population within our school that had no access to college, no pathway there. And if you're familiar with David Douglas High School, we have about 70% of our students are on free and reduced lunch, so pretty high level of poverty. And when you have that sort of of a community, that usually means there's a large portion of students that have not had access, or parents that have not had access to further education. And so they don't really realize what it takes to move on to college. Well, 5 years ago, entered College Possible. We were able to partner with them, and what I've seen in the last 5 years is huge growth. We started with 20 students, and now have grown to where we currently have over 40 students as juniors that are enrolled in the program, and 40 students that are enrolled that are seniors. And we've got two classes that have graduated and are attending local colleges. What I've seen in my building, and so I've jotted down just a few notes: they tutor, they help with FAFSA, they help with applications, with college essays. They prepare students for practice ACT tests, and all you have to do is ask a College Possible kid what's your goal in the ACT, and they know it. They've got it down. They are very dialed in. They counsel, they hug, they do whatever it takes to get kids through there. They also involve families, which is a really important part as well. College Possible is a highly competent organization. They do what they say they're going to do, and they go above and beyond. They hire enthusiastic and competent people, and they really want to be in the building. And it's fun to see those kids, or they are kids compared to us. I've had over the years many conversations with students, and one in particular I'd like to share with you. His name is Brian. He's a young Hispanic male, and when he was a junior, I kept seeing him at just darn near every activity. And he was identifiable because he was always dressed in blazer gear. And, you know, we started kind of just chatting about things and just saying hi. And one day I was standing outside my office, which I do quite a bit after lunch, and just kind of visiting with kids. And he walked by and I said, "Hey, how you doing?" And he introduced myself again. And, you know, when you have 3,000 kids, you can't remember all their names. So asked him what his name was, and we visited a bit. And I said, "You know, I see you at just about everything. You're always involved in stuff." And it's the comment that he made at that point was, "Well, you know, it's College Possible. I would have never been involved in this school and in as many activities as I am if it wasn't for College Possible giving me the courage and the confidence to be involved." So it's not just college prep. It also opens doors for kids in terms of their confidence level. I just ran into Brian the other day. Actually, he stopped by. He's at PCC now. And he mentioned, we talked about College Possible a bit because I knew I was preparing for this. And he said, so I asked him, you know, "What's that like now that you're at PCC?" And he says, "Oh, it's great. I can talk with a tutor anytime I want to. But, you know, it would really be awesome if they had an office there, because I'd love to be able to drop in." He's going to college because of College Possible. That would have never happened. And so many of our students fall in that same category. College Possible gives an opportunity that again, allows kids to go to college that would not. And I think within our community, when that happens, it raises the level of education in our whole community and in the state of Oregon. So we thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you today, and look forward to continuing to work with College Possible, and hopefully with continued funding. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
You should stay there. We might have questions for you.
My name is Casey Block, and I am a program coordinator with College Possible. Thank you so much for the opportunity to join you today. I am in my third year of working at College Possible, and during my first 2 years, my main responsibility was working with our local high school program, where I took the lead on our junior curriculum. I was one of three staff responsible for relationships with our partner high schools in East County. In our local high school program, our coaches lead session to serve students after school twice a week for 2 hours. And in junior year, which I was responsible for, our coaches cover a variety of topics with students, some of which are introduction to college and the application process, introduction to financial aid and scholarships, summer enrichment and volunteer opportunities, beginning the application process by learning about FIT, creating college lists, and writing an application essay, as well as ACT prep. In order to prepare for the ACT, our students are taught content and strategy through a Princeton Review curriculum and take 4 practice tests throughout the year. The past 2 years, our juniors overall have increased their scores 26% and 25% respectively. So as an example, a student with a 16 would increase their score to a 20, which just opens up so many options for them in terms of college acceptance and financial aid opportunities. Senior year, coaches actually begin supporting students through the college application process and financial aid processes. They also support students in completing enrollment steps for college. Students work with their College Possible coach to compare aid packages and make informed decisions about their best fit college based on a variety of different fit factors. And aside from this more tangible college access content, students also build non-cognitive skills like self-advocacy and learn how to be successful on a college campus. As an organization, we have recognized there are many other students who could benefit from our programming. And last year, we began our statewide initiative program to serve students in 7 high schools in parts of Eastern and Northwest Oregon. This year, I'm responsible for the coordination and continued development of this program, and we have now added an 8th partner school. And this program supports students through similar content as our local high school program. However, our coaches support students after school in sessions once a month and utilize a tech-connected approach to provide guidance and support the remainder of the time. Our statewide initiative students face challenges that can often be unique to students in rural areas. We find that there's not a very strong college-going culture in many of our rural schools. And when there is discussion about college access, there's often only an emphasis put on community colleges. These schools often have fewer resources to access things like scholarship and college databases and matching tools, and less exposure to things like campus visits. They are rarely included in admission counselor visits and college recruiting events. I am from a very rural community in southern Illinois, and I am a first-generation college graduate from a low-income background, and I can truly see the value of having a program like College Possible when I was in high school. Unlike most of my classmates, I was lucky enough to attend a 4-year university and graduate with a degree. However, that was not the norm at my high school, based on many of the same challenges I've mentioned we are seeing today in some of our statewide partner schools. My only plan when applying for college was to find a school that appeared to be the cheapest. I had never heard about things like sticker price or college match and fit, and I was convinced that some schools were just out of my reach for people like me. I was just convinced that they weren't possible for me to attend. I know I would have had many more options and opportunities available to me and a much better college experience with the resources, knowledge, and support College Possible works to provide, which is why I'm so excited to be working in our rural program this year. And dedicated funding from the state would allow us to continue to expand both our rural and urban program in a responsible and a sustainable way, and would allow us to continue working with the state to close the degree divide. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. We'll let you go, and then we'll have questions for everybody.
Hello. Hi. Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gia Dahayanan. I'm a second-year student at Willamette University, possibly majoring in creative writing and or sociology. Thank you for your time today. I'm here to tell you about College Possible's impact in my life. So first of all, in high school, I was not a good student. I had teachers that looked at me really scornfully because I skipped their class too often, but they would never ask me why I would skip. I wasn't going to class because my personal life was affecting every aspect of my academic career. My mother was being physically and emotionally abused by my now former ex-stepfather. My confidence was at an all-time low, and my school was not giving me the support that I needed. Looking back at my experience during high school now, I think that I was treated like garbage. I don't think I was given the respect that I deserved. I think that I was failed by the very people that I was supposed to trust, by the very people that were supposed to help me. But College Possible didn't treat me like that. My College Possible coach, Yasmin Folodin Ali, was a person who I felt like I could confide my troubles with and be honest with. In a way, the program felt like a gift because I was able to meet someone like her, an empathetic person who tried to understand me. Thanks to the patience and empathy and the amount of trust and belief in my abilities shown by my College Possible coach, though, I was able to recognize my own worth as a person. It was my College Possible coach who encouraged me to apply for the Gates Millennium Scholarship, a highly competitive scholarship for low-income students of color that is funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The scholarship provides its recipients a full ride to any school they chose to attend. And I didn't expect to receive the scholarship, but somehow I did get it. I cannot stress enough how crucial it is to have someone who treats you and sees you as a person that is capable of bigger things in life. I have all my thanks in the world for the compassion that my College Possible coach gave me during such a traumatic time. I am now a college student with a full ride scholarship, still getting the support that I need from my College Possible coach through a different coach that the program assigns for each of us once we're in college. Despite everything that I just told you right now, though, my story is not a representation of every student that is struggling and in need of a program such as this one. What I want this audience to recognize through my story is that each student, each child that you encounter, each person placed into the margins of the society carries a type of irreversible trauma that affects them in every part of their life. For me, it has been through the relationships that I formed through programs like College Possible was I able to survive through such a hardship. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my experience with you, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions? I guess I'll start with you in that. How did the school or you get tied up with College Possible? How did you find out about it? How did it happen that you were given a coach? And
how did I find out about College Possible in my school?
And how did you get into the program?
So I applied. I think what I remember, because it was such a long time ago. Yeah, I was a sophomore in high school. Now I'm a sophomore in college. Yeah. So that was such a long time ago. I think I saw a flyer somehow in, like, there's this program in our school called the Sun Program. And basically their focus is to help out low-income students, which I am, and also first-generation immigrant. So I saw a flyer on their board thingy, and I, like, saw it, and I was like, oh, I'm kind of interested in college. I don't know if I can go to college, but this might help me go, like, get into it. The process was for, because I'm a low-income student, and the process was the application. You have to fill out an application, talk about why you want to go to college, what are your future aspirations, and all that. And then somehow I got in, too.
We'll let the person sitting next to you explain as well.
So. Yeah.
So we recruit students in their sophomore year, and we present in classrooms, and we work with programs like the Sun Program to help promote our organization, promote our program to students. We do hang flyers in the building and also, like, ask teachers and staff for recommendations as well. And we serve low-income students. We ask that our students have a GPA of 2.0 or higher in our local program, 2.5 or higher in our statewide program, and have, like, an interest in attending a four-year school and feel like they can make the commitment to the program. And once students are interested, They attend a session to learn more about our program and all that it entails. They fill out an application, which they also take home and have a parent or guardian fill out a piece of that as well. And then they come back for an interview. And once that's complete, we sort of review all of the applications that we receive from a school and then accept applicants based on a variety, like that criteria, but we look at the student and the application as a whole.
And so with respect to David Douglas, how big is your school? And I guess, how do you identify, because I think you are relatively large, so that means that there's a lot of these kids that go unnoticed in a school. So how do, and do you use other things like Aspire or any of those other programs?
We don't currently. I was just going to add on to the other thing that we do is table, actually, at lunches. And I'm sorry. We table it, and so College Possible sets up tables at lunch and actually just works the crowd and solicits kids to sign up. And at this point, we are not at capacity, certainly. We could probably double the number of kids at least that would be involved.
David Douglas has...
We have trio. I'm sorry.
How many kids do you have?
3,000, just
yeah,
a
so
little
I was thinking,
under.
Cause maybe the largest school in the state, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so.
Number one. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
And could...
You should come up so you can hear the microphone. Oh. You can stand, though. It's okay.
Hold the mic for you.
There being ground zero, there are, in most of the other schools, we have 140 person cohort for junior year, 140 for senior. In David Douglas, we have two junior cohorts for 80,
yes.
Two senior, and if there were more kids, if there were 40 kids again to start a cohort, we would do three. And, you know, we don't say we're just here for.
And your coaches are AmeriCorps?
They're AmeriCorps.
And I would add, too, one of the things that we've seen is siblings now are starting to sign, so it's spreading through the families, and which is really wonderful to see as well. So
other questions, this group? The only other thing I would say is my family was all from Olney.
Olney? Really?
So which small southern
Sissy,
Illinois? Yeah.
Close to Fairfield, Illinois.
Okay. That's even south, more south of.
Yes.
Than Olney.
Yeah, I never meet anyone. And that was like where
I know. I figured since I don't hear a lot of people coming from Southern Illinois, but
yes, town of 700. So yeah.
And the albino squirrels.
Yes.
Olney, Illinois. So they, other questions or thoughts? I appreciate the program, and I appreciate the fact that. You have identified what you're going to do and not overburdened it. It's really easy when you see the need to lose sight of what the parameters are that you have to work with. And if you have AmeriCorps workers and you have, how many people, one AmeriCorps for 20 kids for a cohort?
We have one coach for a cohort of 40 students.
Oh, for 40 students.
But they meet with their students twice a week.
Okay.
So any given session has anywhere from like 8 to 15, 16 students for that session. So we found that 40 is a good amount so the coach can have really that one relationship with all of their students.
And they're full-time at the school?
Yes. And I would add, too, that they're really flexible. They meet after right. There's a cohort that meets right after school and then a cohort that meets about 5:30 or 6 o'clock. So if kids are involved in athletics or anything like that, they're able to still participate in the program. So they've been extremely flexible working with this as well.
And AmeriCorps has been easy to work with to get enough people? Because I always worry about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, and thank you for coming across the street. We do appreciate you were close by. No, it is really nice, and it's impressive that you not only took a hold of the program. It still intrigues me that you saw a flyer and decided to go. You may have had some other things, but the reality is most sophomores would not have taken the actions that you took. So I give you a lot of credit for yourself, and you need to take a lot of pride in the fact that you were able to help yourself get where you are. I know that from what you said, these people help give you more confidence, but sounding as it did, the situation you were in, to even see the flyer is pretty impressive. To act on it is even more impressive. So you had a lot going for you. There was a strength inside of you that is not available in a lot of students. So thanks for coming and sharing that with us. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we will close our informational hearing on College Possible, and I want to just let you know that we're coming up very quickly on the deadline for bills, and we have three bills available for our committee. My individual bill is already gone, so it's a fisheries thing. And I need to talk with my co-chair some more, but I want to go through the list of bills that have come up, and we did get permission from the Senate president to combine a bunch of them into an omnibus bill, which he was surprised about. And so we need to get together and talk about which ones we feel could go easily together and then decide on the other. So just so everybody has an understanding of what we're trying to do with our bill. One is what came from related to Senate Bill 205, and it we made a deal last time to expedite the certificates. So if you're getting a teaching certificate, we'll give you 90 days if it isn't finished to work, which worked out really nicely, except when we did it, we took away the expedited one, and we only did it for teachers, and there are counselors and administrators and others. And so we took away their ability to get an expedited facility because we took it all away. And so it made a hardship for some of the others. And so this bill would actually say that 90-day opportunity would be available to any of those certificates if they're in the process of getting it done. And secondly, we'll put expedited back because there are some reasons why people would like to have an expedited facility. So that's the first one, which we don't think would have much issues with people. Is there anybody in the audience who likes to speak to that one? I think we're all okay on that one. Next one was the idea of removing the provision describing higher education institutions as sponsors for charter schools. We've had it there for a long time. It's never been used, as I understand it. And it's already sunset. So. And there has not been an ask to have it come back, so we might as well just get it out of the statute. So we're trying to get rid of that one. The next one had to do with Senate Bill 113. And this one was a bill that we passed a number of years ago, but we never really had HEC follow through with it. And if we want, we can talk about it. It had to do with enacting HEC reporting provisions as recommended by House Senate Bill 113 work group. It came up, we had a conversation, but we never followed through with that. Is that correct? You can come on up and how do you feel about this one? So before we start sticking it in, we'd like to make sure that people are appreciative a little bit.
Sure. Senator Roblin, Kyle Thomas, Legislative and Policy Affairs Director for the HEC. There are actually two separate reporting requirements that were passed in the same bill. They're largely related to each other. One of them deals with universities. One of them deals with universities and colleges. And yes, it's true, during the reorganization process, HEC lost access to the data that OUS would have previously had about faculty and salaries and those sorts of things. So it's been difficult for us to keep up with it over time. We've produced it sporadically, but it's true we've missed a couple of years. But the recommendations that were produced and delivered last December are what we're seeking to have codified in this legislation, and we're happy to do so. Actually, Senator Dembrough asked me about it this afternoon. So
it's one that I think everybody's worked out a path forward that shouldn't have a lot of resistance. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next one has to do with we passed a bill to require full-day kindergarten from all of our schools. There was a provision that you could have half-day kindergartens. Some schools think that if you have full-day, you may have to offer half-day as well. And they would like to make sure that it's clear that if you offer full day, you don't have to offer half day. Morgan, anybody else want to speak to that one? But that's kind of it. So that's what we're actually doing there.
This language sounds like you're eliminating the offering half day. But only to those who are offering
full day. Correct.
That we need to be clear as long as we clarify, half day is fine, you can offer half day. Full day is fine, you can offer full day.
Well, except now I think we have a required offer full day. Is that right? No, we aren't. That's right. That's right. Once right. you offer full day, yes, exactly. I agree. It needs to be clear that if you offer full day, you don't have to offer half day. If you offer half day, you don't have to do full day.
Right,
yes.
Right.
And that's why we have this wonderful person for legislative council here to make sure that we get this all right eventually.
I'm not sure if she's bobbing her head yes or no.
She's saying yes. Okay. The next one, Educator Advancement Council currently is placed, needs to be placed into ODE prior to the sunset of the Chief Education Office. So you know the Chief Education Office sunsets this session, right?
2019.
Okay. So in 2019, the Chief Education Office goes away. We need to prepare for that. There are conversations that are happening right now in the governor's office about moving some of the people into the governor's office, doing some other kinds of things. But the one thing we have to do is take the Education Advancement Council and move it to Oregon Department of Education as opposed to leaving it where it is to clear that up so we don't have a problem with it in the future. So that was that one. I got that right? What else want to come say? Come on up. We love Hannah speaking.
Hannah Lai, Legislative Council. Actually, you reversed that, unfortunately.
Oh,
so
right.
It was a mistake. It's been mistakenly moved into the Department of Ed prematurely in anticipation of the sunset. So what we need to do is correct it. So it's with the Chief Education Office until the sunset.
Okay,
so,
I didn't realize that we'd done that. So,
yeah,
okay.
It was
Thank you.
Mistake, but
okay.
We hope to fix it.
We'll leave it where it belongs until it needs to not be there anymore.
Correct.
Okay, fair enough.
Else?
Thank you
yep.
for that. That makes my brain feel better. The other one, Senate Bill 20, was a bill we passed with all good intentions, and it created much consternation for wonderful people like Senator Gelser, because in our good attempt to do the right thing, we ended up doing something that was pretty bad, which is taking some kids who have are in special education classes, and when we gave them their diploma or their modified diploma, they automatically lost the right to continue to go to school till they're 21 and get the transition services that they deserve and need, and we would like to reinstate that. So that one may stand alone just because people want to know what it's going up. Might take our second bill, but that's a conversation. Sarah, do you want to say any more about that bill?
Just
get it back.
Get it back. And that thanks to the good work of folks like Morgan Allen and Cindy Hunt, there is a fix for this school year. So there's been a lot of confusion, concern, excitement in the world. But we got to have a meeting, and it was a really exciting meeting because it was really full, and everybody agreed on what we should do. And then we were confused because we weren't used to all agreeing so quickly, but we all got to know each other better, and it's good.
And the end of it is the right thing is going to happen for a group of kids that
yes.
a really bad thing might have happened for.
Yes, but the bad thing did not actually happen to anybody, and it will not happen to anybody if we pass
this
bill.
If we get this done. Very good. That's important. And I hear a lot of nodding heads on that one.
And can I say one other thing? Hannah did not draft it wrong. It's just all of the guidance from the federal government
right.
kept
we
changing,
that we
and
to
as
do
normal,
something.
Hannah drafted excellent legislation.
Right. We thought we needed to do something we didn't need to do, because there was a lot of other issues here, including we had a waiver, we'd done some other kind of stuff, we'd done a lot of work before, and we're going to work on continuing all that good work that we did. And then the other one, the open enrollment law sunsets 7-1 of 2019, so right after the 19 session. But in talking to people, there is a concern that sometimes we pass these kinds of bills at the very end of the session, and it could go out before the new one comes in, and giving us a little bit more time to talk about it with respect to having one more session, extending it for 1 year. My goal would still be to get done everything we need to do by this date. So in 7-19, I would expect that we have a bill that runs through the session that talks about open enrollment. As we've talked about in the past, open enrollment and the multitude of ways we have to inter-district transfer create a real, from my perspective, mishmash of things, and it would be good to see if we can get to a point where we have a common system that everybody understands. And I have made it clear to people that I am willing to have a work group to work on this, and we can start that work group in December. We got it done beforehand. We could maybe get this all done ahead of time. But I'm willing to get that started fairly soon, because we put a sunset on this a few years ago, and we didn't get back to it. And I take some responsibility for that. So we will have a work group from our committee, and we'll talk to other people who want to be involved in it to come up with a solution for open enrollment.
And I didn't realize that there was a sunset. Open enrollment is a very popular
For a group of people, it's very popular.
Yeah, and so to leave it or extend it or figure out how people, you know, our school districts use it enormously.
Yeah, well, they are not alone. There are a lot of school districts that are using it. There's a lot of school districts that didn't particularly like it. There was a fear when it happened that we would end up having some school districts close down because everybody left. That didn't happen. There was a fear that in doing it, it could create disproportionate people, all the rich kids moving from one place to another. There's whole lots of conversations about it. Most of that, we haven't seen any evidence. We haven't collected a lot of evidence, but we do need to have a conversation, in my opinion, about that.
In our area, it's, you know, it's predominantly county with a municipal school district,
right.
And you need that freedom to go into the school district or out of the school district based on, you know, these urban growth and county's municipal boundaries, to you know, snip that transfer inter-district
right.
transferability would just be terrible.
And some school districts went to inter-district transfer, and it was one for one. If I got one, I'd give one. If I didn't, I didn't. It created other kinds of issues. So it is worth having the conversation. And it sounds like you would approve working on this one, at least.
Sure.
Okay, that's good to hear.
So
the question is, and we will talk about this more. I'll talk to Sarah. Right now, there's three others that are out there hanging at the bottom of the page. One is extending deadline by which teacher preparation programs must be accredited. So there's the CAPE program at universities that has to do with a nationwide accreditation program for schools. Some of the independent colleges, I think University of Oregon, there's a group of colleges that don't feel like they will be ready by the deadline in this, and they would like to extend it a little bit to get that taken care of. There's other people who are worried that if we do that, they're really trying to just do away with it. I don't think that's the issue, but there is a conversation about whether they can be ready by the deadline, which is something like 2021 or some other thing, 2022. But we'll talk about that one some more and get the more details. Next, requiring colleges and universities to extend credit for certain results on international baccalaureate exams. I will be having a conversation. You know, we did this for SAT and ACT. AP. That's right. We did it for AP.
Yeah, we did for AP.
And so this was a conversation that came up at the time about international baccalaureate. I will be meeting with some of the people to see if there's a way to do it. It was too impossible at the time to do it then, so we'll see if this is a 18 or a 19 kind of issue. And then making permanent the ability for online charter schools to hire their own principal. Right now, there's one group that does that. It's K-12. They wanted the ability. We gave it to them, a number of years ago with a sunset.
With a sunset right now.
Yep. And I have talked to the reason we did it at the time was really about one person. I think Sarah mentioned that. It was somebody that I knew who was retiring and wanted to go back and work. So if he worked with the district, he couldn't retire and get PERS. So we made this arrangement. They like that model, the K-12 does. I have had conversations and continue to have conversations with the local North Bend School District Superintendent and their board to find out where they're at on that one. And once I get a final answer from them, we'll make a decision if we put that into anything. So I just want to make sure everything was out on the table that I've heard. And if you have any others, let me know. But I'm, do you?
I was in a conversation the other day, and it was unclear whether there was a vehicle in this for the House, but there's a group of people that have been meeting. Dana Hepper was kind of leading up the charge, and it has to do with expanding the eligibility of developmental delay. Right now, that ends at age 5 up through age 8 or 9 years old, because these kids fall out of special ed eligibility. Anyway, they were looking for vehicles. I said they might want to talk to you.
Yeah, she did touch base with me, but she seemed, I'll have to go back and look at that one, because the last time I had the conversation, I think they thought they had a bill, but
okay.
They do?
Yeah, they're working with Representative Lively's committee.
Okay, great.
So we're okay now, because they did talk to me, and I agree. I think I would have done something in that case, too, because telling people they have to start kindergarten when they're not really ready is not necessarily the best thing for the child, family, or everybody else.
Are you considering these three bullets under other going into the omnibus number
Any,
one?
If possible,
if
yes.
If possible.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that more. Yeah. And we need to have this all to our good counsel before the 21st, and I would like to have it done before the end of this week. So I'll sit down. We'll try to get some time with you to work on that. And right now we do have all three, so we could, if there are ones that you feel clearly should stay on their own, let me know. Sarah, you've already said that special education one, you would like to see it on its own committee bill, correct? If possible.
If possible, or with things that are so totally non-controversial. Impact of not passing that would have a consequence that would
correct.
Be hard to unwind.
And the other one.
Well, what's the fix today? You've got a fix today,
yes.
That
we
somehow.
We just restore two words that we took out.
Right now, this year,
they
did a fix. They just agreed that they weren't going to implement it.
It was a temporary rule change by the State Board of Education.
Okay.
But we need to fix the statute, and that's what this bill would do, which is take those couple words out that we put in last time. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, if the fix was that easy, you know, let the guys in rules change.
Well, they can't. They could do a temporary rule this session. They felt pretty comfortable with that. They don't feel that that is one that could last and that we should change the statute to make it right. So that's what that's for.
Okay. I was just curious, how complex was the rule change that they...
It seemed to be really complex for about 3 or 4 weeks when everybody was talking to me. It was going crazy. And then when they all got together, they found out it wasn't quite as complex.
Yeah.
Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, if you'd like, I can put my phone on call forwarding to your phone.
Well, I'll just tell them it's fixed.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly.
I know the answer. It's fixed.
So we will, I'll try to have Rosie set up a time when you and I can meet with our, okay, and we'll get that done. So any questions from any of the wonderful people sitting out the audience that have spent all this time with us? We will let you know if you're interested in any of these, whether it got in or not, in the next day or couple days, so you'll know. I didn't hear a lot of concerns about most of them, so we'll do it, and we'll figure out which ones go along to make sure. I do feel your urgency to make sure that doesn't get caught with something else. So.
I feel your urgency.
Yes. She put a lot of effort into this. She took a lot of phone calls.
As did Lisa and Morgan and Hannah and Cindy Hunt and God.
Okay. With that, is there any other business to come before us? Thank you very much. So we will adjourn the Senate Education Interim Committee. Thank you all. Interim Committee. Thank you all. Education.